Good morning and welcome to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. Coming up, some political experts will analyze the results of the election. First, now that the elections are over, the remnants remain. Yard signs, buttons, posters, and the like. Some of them may be worth thousands of dollars someday. Elizabeth Kramer reports.
The phones at area bookstores have been ringing off the hook.
We have Time and People Right Now and also Newsweek with him on the cover.
That's Books A Million employee Casey Bryant, who has been telling dozens of callers since last week that the store does not have the newspapers they want. People have been calling looking for newspapers with the president-elect on the cover and often finding none. The callers are hunting them down as mementos from the historic presidential election of Barack Obama. And entrepreneurs are getting in on the frenzy. Last Wednesday's New York Times is attracting bids of almost $100 on eBay. On Craigslist, sellers of that day's Washington Post are asking $50. But serious collectors of campaign memorabilia say newspapers aren't really worth that today and won't even appreciate beyond their newsstand price over years or even decades. Throughout the recent atypical election, serious collectors have been, well, collecting all sorts of things depicting the candidates, from the posters and pens to toys and purses.
I picked up a Barack Obama purse from someone out in Hawaii that was supposed to be a limited edition of about 50 purses. Two little three-dimensional toys, one of Obama and one of McCain. McCain says he's armed to the dentures with experience and vote for me and hope for the best on the Obama one.
Prospect resident Bob Westerman has these gems in a cabinet in his basement. All around are posters, pins, and license plates from elections dating back more than 100 years. He's been at it since 1980 and is a member of a group called the American Political Items Collectors. His most valuable piece is a pin from 1899 for William Jennings Bryan, who was a three-time Democratic Party presidential nominee around the turn of the 19th century. The pin is worth about $5,000. Westerman says limited edition pieces with city and date references are worth more. Westerman and other Louisville collectors also buy original handmade pieces and others created by artists in limited editions, like that purse with President-elect Obama. One artist who's been successful among collectors is Brian Campbell, who creates pins from his acrylic paintings. Westerman has a box packed with Campbell pins, one with Senator John McCain in an uncomfortable embrace with President George Bush, and another depicting Arizona McCain in a pose mimicking an Indiana Jones movie poster. One recent purchase has a simple image, an arm held high with a fist tightly gripping a plunger. Brian Campbell says the pins aren't promoting a candidate or really towing any party line.
The pins themselves will kind of tell a story, and you'll see that pin 30 years from now, and what is this guy holding, a plunger? And somebody will tell the story of Joe the plumber that we heard more about than maybe we wanted to.
Buyers wanting that pin or others can get them through a network of dealers. Most of them are elected officials or political junkies like Westerman. And Westerman has some advice for anyone collecting items from this year's campaign. He says where investing is concerned, look for rare pieces, those that have pics of the presidential candidates with their running mates, and those made by artists and craftspeople. Westerman says, who knows what will be valuable.
There's some things I'm sure from this election that haven't even crossed my mind as what might be a collectible. But, you know, 30 or 40 years from now, you know, it's, golly, I didn't even know those existed, you know, at that time.
Westerman says, save what most collectors save, those pieces that you personally like and that have meaning to you. For WFPL, I'm Elizabeth Kramer.
At last week's Louisville Forum, a panel of political experts discussed this year's presidential and senatorial elections. The panelists were writer and University of Louisville professor Ricky Jones, political writer Al Cross, Democratic political consultant Danny Briscoe, and Hunter Bates, former chief of staff to U.S. Senator Mitch McConnell. The group discussed Kentucky's voting habits and why the state favored Republicans in an election where most states went for Democrats. Jones and Cross offered their insights into why Kentuckians voted the way they did.
I disagree with the national narrative that this election was moved by the economic crash prior to the election. Before the economic crash happened, I wrote that what this election would be a referendum against the Republican Party for a number of reasons. Let us remember, this is the party of Bob Ney, Mark Foley, affiliations with Jack Abramoff, Scooter Libby. The list goes on and on and on. Last time I checked, Karl Rove was still on the run. I was waiting for somebody to come on to Fox News and pull him off the set on Tuesday night. And I was in, when I was in D.C. giving election commentary for Al Jazeera in English. This is a small party. About 35% of registered voters in this country are Republican. It is continuously moving toward being a regionalized party that makes its bones on wedge issues that quite often speak to xenophobic type of tendencies, which I think are damaging to the American consciousness. I think they are damaging to global relations and damaging to the world overall. It is not one that simply does not speak to certain issues that trouble us. It is a party that, in my opinion, absolutely exacerbates issues of racism, ethnic discrimination, discrimination against people who have different sexual choices, discrimination against people who have other religious affiliations. And we have to be very, very clear on that, and I think Americans are starting to catch hold of this. I've been following politics since I was 9 years old. Yes, I'm a nerd. I'm proud of that. Most of my adult life, I've spent studying, speaking to, and writing about politics. I've watched almost every convention since 1976. Remember, I'm a Georgian. So in 1976, when I was 9 years old, Georgians were very excited because Jimmy Carter was running for president. So those were my first conventions. I watched the Republican convention this year, and I watched the Democratic convention. The Democratic convention, I think, was reflective of what America looks like now. And let me say this so people can understand. I am not a Democrat. I'm to the left of the Democrats. I generally find Democrats to be soft. I find their messages to be unclear. I find them to be cowardly politicians who simply run not to lose. And that's why usually they've lost. My sister, who has never run a political campaign in her life, could have beaten any Republican candidate this year. Let's be clear. The real race this year was the Democratic primary. This was a challenger's environment. But when I look at the Democratic convention, one thing I can say for the Democrats, in the most multiracial, multi-ethnic, multicultural America in the history of the world, this convention reflected it. I look at the Republican convention, and it does not. It is a homogeneous party. The only black person I saw there was Lynn Swann. And I think any other black person that you think you saw was Lynn Swann, who had gone to the back and changed clothes to present himself as someone else. So if the Republicans don't make adjustments on this, I think they're going to have serious problems. You're not going to be able to win elections consistently on gay marriage and abortion. It is not going to happen. Neither should it happen.
I think the fundamental question that has been raised in by our first three speakers is, was this a realignment election? Maybe. You know, in 1932, they didn't recognize it as a realignment election. But in 1936, the realignment was confirmed. And I think it is within the clear realm of possibility for Obama and the Democrats to complete a realignment in 2012. One of the most persuasive poll results I saw this year was a Pew poll, which found that 53% of Americans thought that government needed to be doing more. If you had to boil down the philosophy of the Democratic Party versus the Republican Party, you've got more people agreeing that government should do more. The pendulum has swung back. The Reagan Revolution is over. But Kentucky, once again, lags behind. I'm not sure of the number of years, but supposedly Mark Twain said that when he died, he wanted to be in Kentucky because we were always 20 years behind. In this case, we are swimming against the tide of history. You know, you had states like Virginia and North Carolina voting for not just a Democrat, but a black Democrat. In this state, Obama lost by 17 points. Now, that's partly because he didn't contest the state. I think if he had paid some attention to it, he could have gotten that down to single digits. But we are part of the race belt. One of the more striking maps produced after this election showed a swath of counties beginning in southwest Pennsylvania, going through West Virginia, thickening as you came into eastern Kentucky and southwest Virginia, almost filling up Tennessee and Arkansas, getting into Little Dixie in Oklahoma, and ducking down into Louisiana. Counties where John McCain did 5 points or better than George Bush did in 2004. Now, in a political environment that we had in this country in the last 6 months, why in the world would John McCain do better than Bush in some places? The fundamental answer to that is race. And it's hard to quantify. As I pointed out in the column Sunday, when you start asking people about their reasons for voting, self-analysis gets pretty tricky. But we have to look at the exit polls and see that 9% of the respondents in the Kentucky exit poll said that the race of the candidates was the most important factor in their vote. And 56% of those voted for McCain. So that is 5 points off the top that went to McCain that would have otherwise gone to Obama. Then you have people for whom race was a factor or an important factor. And it adds up pretty fast. Now, other factors tie into this. You know, when people saw Obama as a liberal and somebody who didn't even bother to come to Kentucky and campaign, then I think it gets intertwined and it's hard to assign the reasons. But we're clearly in that belt. We're clearly on the wrong side of history. And that was great for Mitch McConnell. You know, if Hillary Clinton had been the Democratic nominee, Mitch McConnell might very well have lost this election, Hunter. I'd be interested in your opinion on that. Sure, Bruce Lunsford was a horribly flawed candidate, could not develop, Danny likes to say you got to get the talk right in an election. Bruce never got the talk right. Democrats would not talk him up. He couldn't produce an organization, which you've got to have to turn out Democratic vote. And yet, he came within 6 percentage points, 100,000 votes. If you had a better candidate at the top of the ticket, I think the result in the Senate race might very well have been different, because Kentucky would have been contested. Democrats would have felt good about being Democrats. That's the key for the Democratic Party in the state. You have all these Democrats of heritage who are still registered that way but tend not to vote that way. And they would have been more inclined to go hold their nose and vote for Lunsford if they'd had a more appealing candidate at the top of the ticket. And that's especially true in the rural areas, which still constitute about 40% of the vote in this state. We were asked to look ahead past the election results, and I think that for Obama, you got to go back to James Carville's line in 1992 with the Clinton campaign. "It's the economy, stupid," is not the campaign slogan this time, but it's a governing slogan. For the first 6 months, I think he has to concentrate on the economy. And if people think that he's heading in the right direction, he will solidify these results that we picked up in these polls after the election, showing that people have a good opinion of him. I think that McConnell has as his primary job keeping together his party in the Senate. The Democrats are going to have probably 57. I think Lieberman will continue to caucus with them. They might pick up one more seat. You know, when you look at Arlen Specter, Olympia Snow, and Susan Collins, those are some pretty easy picks for Democratic proposals. And the senator will have his time full managing his own caucus. And I doubt that he's going to get very involved in the debates within the Democratic Party about who ought to be leading it. He's smarter than to be part of a circular firing squad, and I think you could see that in the paper this morning, where he basically is offering no help to his fellow Kentuckian Mike Duncan, who would like to be Republican chairman again. Thanks.
That was political writer Al Cross and U of L professor Ricky Jones discussing the election at the Louisville Forum. Child advocates have Kentucky payday lenders in their sights as they unveil their legislative priorities for the 2009 Kentucky General Assembly. Kentucky Public Radio's Tony McVeigh has details.
Ohio Governor Ted Strickland this year signed into law a measure reducing annual interest rates on payday loans from 391% to 28% and limiting Ohioans to 4 loans per year. Payday lenders who say they're offering a service to people who may not otherwise be able to obtain loans cried foul. They say the law will force closure of many businesses and put 6,000 people out of work. The lenders mounted an $18 million campaign to repeal the law. But on Election Day, 64% of Ohio voters rejected the repeal. Among those closely watching the vote was Tara Grishup Goodwin of Kentucky Youth Advocates.
So not only did the legislature see fit to put a cap on the amount of interest that payday lenders can charge, but the voters came and they said, despite the money that the industry is paying to overturn this, we as voters think that it is a good move and it is a positive move for our families.
Terry Brooks of Kentucky Youth Advocates says the payday industry's argument that interest caps will put them out of business just doesn't wash.
The Pentagon and Defense Department have put a 36% cap on payday lenders around military bases. They actually believe that that was an issue of national security, that military personnel were falling into debt at such a level that they put that cap on. It's interesting that the payday lenders around military bases are still in business.
A bill placing restrictions on payday lenders in Kentucky failed in this year's legislative session. The measure, which omitted interest rate caps, passed the House 56-35 but died in the Senate. Child advocates who say payday loans trap some families in cycles of debt supported the measure. Terry Brooks says a new bill is coming, and this time with caps.
Most of us probably have ideal caps, and I think some of the calculation is political feasibility. What can we get passed?
Child advocates have made it one of their top priorities for the 2009 session. Another is increasing the state's graduation rate by raising the dropout age from 16 to 18. June Widman of the Eastern Kentucky Child Care Coalition says keeping young people in school can help ease their transition into adulthood.
It's been an issue in Kentucky for a long time. It waxes and wanes in terms of importance, and we want to put some focus back on it.
Last year, Kentucky had a dropout rate of 3%. The graduation rate is 83%. Another legislative priority for child advocates is reducing the use of secure detention for children charged with offenses that, if committed by adults, would not be crimes. Bart Baldwin of the Children's Alliance prefers alternatives to detention.
Whether it's in-home incarceration or whether it's group homes or foster homes versus secure detention. And I think that's, most cases, the more appropriate placement for a status offender, which is a nonviolent offender, obviously.
Missing from the priority list is an increase in the state's cigarette tax, which many youth advocates strongly support. Terry Brooks says it's not an oversight.
I certainly can speak for KYA. We are actively supporting that, but I think the blueprint represents, you know, dozens of groups, and I don't think any of the groups on the blueprint are against it, but I think some are taking a neutral position on it.
The blueprint he refers to is the Blueprint for Kentucky Children. It's a 6-year roadmap promoting safe and healthy families, a fair deal for working parents, and fair opportunity for all children. More than 60 child advocacy groups helped develop the blueprint and its legislative priorities. For Kentucky Public Radio, I'm Tony McVeigh in Frankfort.
When we come back, Robin Fisher talks with former U.S. Surgeon General Joycelyn Elders. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. Coming up, we'll have part of Rick Pitino's address to the Louisville Rotary Club last week. First, in 1993, Dr. Joycelyn Elders became the 15th Surgeon General of the United States. 15 months and numerous controversial statements later, she was out of a job and on her way back to Arkansas. But Dr. Elders has no regrets about her time in Washington and thinks her messages are as relevant now as they were 15 years ago. Dr. Elders took some time out of her schedule to talk with Robin Fisher about her experiences in Washington, where she thinks we are with health care, and what she's working on now.
So I have to ask you, before I jump into any sort of medical discussion, you know, we're getting ready to head into a whole season of nominees and appointees and hearings and in the whole, you know, mess, honestly. And I just wondered what advice you have for someone who's getting ready to step right into that.
You know, the advice that I would have for our new president is to make sure that he takes his time, picks the people he wants to do the things he needs to do very carefully, and to try and make sure that his transition team is on the same page and getting people that are on the same page with him, and don't worry about their political affiliation. Just try and get absolutely the very best people there are in the country, and I think he's going to do that.
What advice do you have for someone who is, in fact, a nominee, and they're facing down this what could be an easy process, or it could be a very rancorous process?
I would, for any nominee who's being considered for any of the positions, top positions, I would tell them, first of all, and I know they'll all know that, that it's going to be a very rigorous process, and that they're going to work harder than they've ever worked in their lives. They're going to be criticized more, but nothing, nothing is more rewarding. You can be doing something you know that will affect millions of people, and you know, and you want to make absolutely the very best decisions, and it will last a lifetime. So it's really rewarding, and you just feel wonderful about it.
You know, as I was reading your book, one thing that struck me is it seemed a lesson to learn from your experience for anyone heading into a new position is that what works on a small scale might not be as easy to accomplish on a larger scale. You know, what eventually worked for Arkansas,
right?
It hit too many roadblocks for the country at large.
Oh, you're absolutely right. However, I had been working on those problems that I ran into for 6 years in Arkansas before I came to Washington, and all of the people in public health worked directly for the health department. So I obviously had an awful lot more control. And I think that the things that I was talking about and discussing for the entire country, I think was very important. It's just that you have to get the country up to the page you're on. You can't just jump in the middle and feel that everybody is where you are. We had a major AIDS epidemic going on that's still going on. We had a major problem with teenage pregnancy. We had a health illiterate society, and we didn't have a health care system. We had a very expensive sick care system, and I just felt that, I rushed in and wanted to get everything done yesterday. Well, obviously, you can't do that. You have to realize where people are, and you have to learn how to use rules, regulations, and the bully pulpit to move the country to where you are.
It seems like you had to learn how to play the game.
Well, that's playing the game is an important part of it. But, we're never going to get everybody on the same page. We just have to try and move as many people as we can to get done what's in the best interest of this country. And, to me, I was about preventing unplanned pregnancies. And I think that many people are about preventing sex. Well, I wasn't worried about preventing sex. If I could prevent teenage pregnancy, prevent STDs, prevent HIV and AIDS, I would have felt that I had done my job as a public health person. And, and I think that other people were perhaps more concerned about the moral issues. But until we can educate our society, we can't moralize our major health issues away.
Did you ever feel that some days, every time you said something, it turned out to be the wrong thing?
Well, you know, I feel that maybe every time I said something, there were people out there criticizing what I said, but I didn't necessarily feel that I was saying the wrong thing. Even that, as far as I'm concerned, was not wrong. I was not lying. And you know, we need to make our young people, you know, they said, well, I was going to teach children how to masturbate, which is a lie. Nobody ever had to teach anybody how to masturbate.
Do you think that your job might have been a little bit smoother if your issue had not been sex-oriented, but instead had been, say, an anti-smoking campaign?
I think that might have been true. But, you know, we've never been able to talk about sex. We've been silent on that issue forever. Yet sexual health is very, very important. It's the major cause of poverty and ignorance in our country, the major cause of health disparities. So I feel that it's time we began to educate our young people and began to talk about it. You see, our country hasn't accepted it, has not learned to talk about it. And so it's something that we've just, every time it comes up, we push it back in the closet. And when we can openly and honestly begin to talk with our young people, I think that we'll find that we'll have far fewer problems than we have now. Why is it that other industrialized countries don't have these same kinds of problems to the extent that we have? It's because they educate their young people.
Something else that was one of not only your issues, but one of the administration's issues was universal health care.
Yes. And it's
why have we not made any progress on this?
We are at the same place, or maybe even further behind, because of all of the economy. You know, so the fact that our country is the only industrialized country that does not provide universal access to health care for all of its citizens. And what we have, we've got the best sick care system in the world. The only thing is we do not have a health care system. We spend more than anyone else on health care, double digits. We're the richest country in the world. We spend almost 15% of our gross domestic product, $2 trillion, and the next country that spends the next is Canada, and they only spend 10% of their gross domestic product. And so we spend enough money. The problem is we do not have the best health. We rank number 57th behind other industrialized countries in our overall goodness and fairness of our health. We are number 41 in teenage pregnancy. We used to be, our white women used to have, life expectancy was number 6 in the world. Now we're number 26. So we've got a problem. And the problem is we don't provide health care.
Do you think that part of
sick care?
Do you think that part of the solution is educating people on healthy behavior?
Yes. We need to have comprehensive health education as a part of our school from kindergarten through 12th grade. Teach young people good nutrition. Teach them. We took physical education out of school, and now we're complaining that we're all getting fat. So I'm saying we do things that come back to remind us that we're not doing the things we need to be doing to have a healthy population, and we pay very dearly for it. We pay in bigger hospital bills, more heart disease, more cancer, gallbladder disease, arthritis, all the things that are associated with high blood pressure, stroke, with increased obesity, diabetes.
Well, it sounds to me that you are still keeping up with the nation's health, and I wondered if, in fact, you were actually working on anything now, or are you going around and sharing your wisdom, or what's going on with you?
Oh, I still run around and talk a lot, and I am, in fact, the reason I'm in New Orleans, they're having a major conference, a leadership conference for young people, and it's called Treating and Testing People of Color. And this has been going on for several years, and I've mentored some students through this kind of program. But I still do a lot of public speaking. I do a little bit of writing. And I am very concerned about the state of health of our nation, and especially our adolescents.
Well, Dr. Elders, thank you so much for your time.
Oh, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you for having me.
That was Robin Fisher talking with former United States Surgeon General Joycelyn Elders. Dr. Elders will be the keynote speaker on Saturday for the Kentucky Alliance's 11th Annual Unity Dinner. For more information, visit our website, WFPL.org. The Louisville Cardinals men's basketball team begins regular season play next weekend in the Billy Minardi Classic against Morehead State. Last week, head coach Rick Pitino spoke to the Louisville Rotary Club. Here are a few of his remarks about the upcoming season.
I'm excited to be here with you. We're kind of busy. I was planning on doing a little book signing afterwards, but unfortunately have a conference call. We've been practicing almost double sessions every day for a variety of reasons. We really struggle with picking up the system, even though we have a lot of returning players. I'm very proud that our teams at times will play their best basketball in March, and we struggle early on. Every one of my teams for some reason does that, and it's primarily because I coach it sort of like a professional team. The professional teams only have about 10 days to get ready before their first exhibition game. And we put all our sets in, all our defenses in, and I do the same thing at the collegiate level, except there's so many more sets to put in, so many more trapping defenses to put in at the collegiate level. For instance, right now we have about 12 different offensive sets in, 3 zone sets. Then we have 4 different full court presses, a half court trap. You have to get in all your out of bounds plays, and we do it all in the first 10 days. So what happens is you're mediocre at all those things. And each week you get better and better and better at it because there's too many things. The other day we had the Vanderbilt coach in to watch practice, and he said he had 2 offensive sets, 1 of his defensive sets in, and he couldn't believe how many different things we're doing at this stage. And it's difficult on the players, especially the freshman who is seeing it for the first time. And right now we struggle with our first 2 exhibition games, although both opponents were very good for us. Georgetown is always very good for us. They've been practicing probably about 7 to 8 weeks to our 2 weeks, and they're way ahead of us from an execution standpoint. And then the other night we played Northern Kentucky University on the road, which doesn't usually happen. And that was great for us as well because we had to defend a bunch of perimeter players, actually 4 guards and maybe 1 swing man. And it was great for our big men to have to go out in the perimeter and try to defend them. So both exhibition games were great for us, and we are progressing, but we're going double sessions all the time now. And we used to go 6:30 in the morning and then the afternoon. Now we go 2:45, and then we go again about 8:30, 9 o'clock in the evening. Our guys, I don't know whether they stay out all night, but they're not good at 6:30 in the morning. They're just not good. So we learned our lessons. We call it the Derek character rule. He was just getting in at 5:30, so it's for that 6:30 practice. So we learned some valuable lessons. Now we ask the guys, we've incorporated a lot of discipline to our team. We ask the guys to get in by 4 o'clock. So we've improved on that area. And of course, you know I'm only kidding for those who go on those silly call-in shows. You know, about the call-in shows, I never forget it. I have not listened to a call-in show since 1987. That's a true story. I have a young man who works for me, Jordan. Every time I get in the car, he has like ESPN radio on. Not as bad as some of those others. And I said, Jordan, please change the channel. Put on some music or shut it off. I don't listen to that. He said, why not, coach? I tell him this story. I said, 1987, we're on a long winning streak with the New York Knicks. We're in first place. We just came back from a road trip, and we won 3 out of 5 on the road, which is great. We're getting ready to tie. No, excuse me. We already tied the record for the most home victories consecutively at 29. We were going to snap the Boston Celtic record of 29 and go to 30. Hold that distinction. I lived in a place called Bedford, New York, which would be very similar to Paris, Kentucky. You have deer on your property. It's extremely rural. And you're only an hour out of New York City. So I had the same driver pick me up for every game. And Walter would get in the car and same route to coach, great road trip. You want me to turn on some music, coach? I said, that'd be great, Walter. He said, you look exhausted. I said, Walter, we went through Texas, then we went Seattle and Golden State. And we've got to win this game, though, Walter. We're going to snap the Celtic record. He said, why don't you close your eyes, coach? I'll turn on some music, and I'll wake you up around the GW Bridge by the FDR Drive. I said, great. He said, hey, coach, you want to listen to the hottest thing out? I said, what's that? He said, WFAN, All Sports Talk Radio. I said, well, remember, now, this is 1987. I said, well, what is it? Well, they talk sports. They call in. They mention you all the time. And I said, why not? Everybody wants to be patronized once in a while, and we're in first place. We're going to snap the record. Everybody likes to hear a compliment every now and then. Turn it on, Walter. First caller, Vinny from Bensonhurst. Go ahead, Vinny. That's the Italian section of Brooklyn. Go ahead, Vinny. You're on the fan. First time caller, Mike Pitino. Yeah, some story, huh? Yeah, it is some story. They should fire him tomorrow. Well, why do you say that, Vinny? He presses too much. He's killing their legs. They'll have nothing left for the playoffs. I don't care how many points they score, how many games they win. He should be fired and fired now. Well, literally, I almost pop into the front seat. I put my chin on the thing. I said, Walter, what did he say? He said, coach, just listen. Next call. He thought somebody would refute that statement. Mike from Bay Ridge. Couldn't agree with Vinny anymore. He needs to go now. They shoot way too many three-point shots. You can't play that style in the pros. He needs to go. I agree with Vinny. Well, I am devastated. I turned to Walter. I said, Walter, does this go on all the time? He said, coach, actually, they love you. You should see what they say about the Jet Giant coaches and their wives and families. They kill them. So I was fascinated by this medium. And in New York, a lot different than Kentucky, you're always stuck in traffic, sometimes 45 minutes to an hour. And I was fascinated by this, and I would drive home from the garden at night on the way in and listen to WFAN for a two-week span. I noticed myself getting very depressed after getting out of the car, and I noticed quite a few things. I noticed two things that stick out to this day. Back then, it was the 4% unemployment rate. I knew where they roam each and every day. Now it's going to 7.4 probably unemployment rate that listen to these people. Only the unemployed listen to these sports call-in shows. Or there's three categories of people. The unemployed, because they have a lot of time on their hands. Two, people that have lost a lot of money in gambling and they want to talk about their woes and try to get an edge. And three, clinical morons. So those are the three categories. I hope you fall into the third. I hope you're not losing any money and you're not unemployed. But it was fascinating about it, and one of the reasons why I don't listen to it anymore, everybody was very angry when you listened to these shows. There wasn't any really educated people in terms of wanting to find out more about the sport or giving something back to the show. It was very angry people. There are some terrific hosts throughout the country, but I noticed that 80% of the people calling in were very angry, and I noticed they weren't open to listening. So I shut it off from that point to today, and I've been very happy since. I really love listening to the Eagles. I love listening to good music, and it's great. I haven't been annoyed now since 1987, which is terrific. The media today and how we deal with it. I always go around talking to coaches, and they always say, how do you deal with the media? I said, well, I'm lucky because I live in Kentucky now, but the media is very fair here. I think they're objective, I think they're talented, and I think they're fair. But when you coach in New York and Boston, it's not objective and it's not fair. So you must completely tune it out or have the thickest rhino skin possible. The only place I have not coached to have the big three is Philadelphia. If you coach in Philly, Boston, or New York, you go right to heaven. You get a free pass right to heaven because the media is very tough. Media is fair and objective. But what you have to do is understand competition. See, we're a one newspaper town. So they can be fair and objective. When you're in New York and it's the Post and the News, or the Globe and the Herald, or the New York Times, Long Island Newsday, they have to compete. Along with competition, you must fabricate. You must go along and you must get people to read your newspaper. So you understand it. And that's the key to coaching today. You understand the media. You don't criticize the media. That's their job. You don't pass judgment. That's their job. What you do is you focus in on your job. And that's the key.
That was Rick Pitino talking about the upcoming season for his men's basketball team at the University of Louisville. The Cards won their two exhibition games against Georgetown and Northern Kentucky. They face Morehead State Saturday night at 5:30. When we come back, I'll speak with author Richard Paul Evans. You're in Studio 619 on WFBL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. Back in the early 1990s, advertising executive Richard Paul Evans wrote a Christmas-themed story as a memento of affection for his daughters. That story, The Christmas Box, would eventually become a best-selling book, and Evans would become a full-time author. Evans has just published his 12th novel, Grace, which also has a Christmas backdrop. I spoke with Evans about the book, his charitable work, and his appearance tomorrow at the Louisville Free Public Library. Well, tell us about Grace, your new book, and what inspired it.
Grace is a story of a young runaway girl, and what started me down this path on this book. I was actually going to write something about the homeless when I was interviewing social workers, and I learned about this intriguing fact that in the late 50s, early 60s, there was a cultural phenomenon. There were thousands of girls on the streets, and they're just running away from homes, and just by the thousands, and they were good girls. They didn't fit the norm of what you would think a runaway would be. And of course, today we would understand why. It's because they were being abused at home. But what was so interesting to me to find out is back then, they didn't know why. And the girls wouldn't tell them, and they wouldn't get a straight answer. During that time, our eyes were so shut to any kind of abuse in the home that there was a lot going on. And so Grace is the story of one of those girls. It's also the story of two young boys who find this girl in the dumpster, and they bring her home to live in their clubhouse. And so it's a sweet romance, but it's not a light story. It's actually a very deep story as these boys try to protect her and keep her safe.
Now, I know as you have in the past, you've launched an initiative in conjunction with this book to help runaways.
Yes. When I launched my first book, The Christmas Box, we started building shelters for abused and neglected children. And we've housed more than 20,000 abused children since we started. We started 3 years ago something new. We wanted to help the older youth who were leaving foster care because the numbers on these kids are horrible. More than 60% of them will end up within a year either incarcerated homeless or dead. And so we decided that we'd reach out to them, and we've started with this initiative where we have what we call Life Start Kits. And on these Life Start Kits that for these youth when they leave, we give them the things they need to start a life and also a connection, someone to go to, so that if they run into problems that they can call us and we can help them.
Now, we've had a problem, I guess it's a nationwide thing, we've had a problem here with the aging out, the youngsters, no place to go after aging out of the foster system.
Exactly.
Now, your story is interesting. Prior to being an author, you were in the advertising business, is that correct?
That's right.
And you published a few copies of a story that you had written. Tell us that story about how you got into the publishing business.
Well, I started out as a Christmas present. I wrote a little story called The Christmas Box. And that was it was a present for my daughters. And when I finished writing it, I decided my wife liked the book so much that I decided to make a few extra copies. So I made 20 copies and handed them out. And within a few weeks, those 20 copies had been read hundreds of times. And soon bookstores began calling with orders for an unpublished book. So at that point, I started sending it out to publishers, hoping someone would publish it, and no one wanted it. So I self-published the book, and it kept growing and growing until it hit number 2 on the New York Times bestseller list. And then the whole world wanted the book. Then I started receiving multi-million-dollar offers over the telephone, and I ended up selling the rights to Simon & Schuster, and it became they brought it out. It became a number 1 bestseller and a number 1 television movie of the year, and has since spread throughout the world. There's more than 8 million copies in print.
Now, you're going to be coming to Louisville on Monday, the 17th. What happens at these appearances?
This one is a little bit different. This is a library event. It's interesting. I've had 2 of them this year, and this is the first time I haven't had one for a decade. So these events, I come and I talk and I answer questions. And so what I usually find as I get to meet readers and new people who haven't read my book, and I get to talk about what drives the books. They're really interesting and fun conversations. And then afterwards, there will be a book signing.
I see. Now, some of your previous work has been adapted to television. Any plans to do that with this book?
Well, we're always hoping. I've had 4 television movies made of my books. I had a major producer, actually, co-producer along with Spielberg, Reed, sent me an email yesterday and tell me how much he loved Grace. He said, some books you close and you're done, and this one I can't close in my mind. So that was really nice to hear. I hope it turns into a movie.
Well, and this has just been released, correct?
It just came out. It came out 4 weeks ago. It's debuted at number 8 on the New York Times bestseller list, and it's been on the extended list the entire time.
Well, the name of the book is Grace. The author is Richard Paul Evans, who will be at the Louisville Free Public Library Monday. Thanks for joining us today.
You bet.
Richard Paul Evans will appear at the Louisville Free Public Library tomorrow night at 7 o'clock. More information about the visit and Richard Paul Evans is available at our website, WFPL.org. You can learn more about today's show or start an online conversation on our blog at WFPL.org. You can also email us from there or listen to previous broadcasts in our audio archive. You can write to us at Studio 619, 619 South 4th Street, Louisville, Kentucky 40202, or you can reach us by phone at 502-814-6500. Studio 619 is produced by Louisville Public Media. Everything you hear on Studio 619 is compiled by the staff at LPM, which includes WFPL, WFPK, and WUOL. We also air submissions from Kentucky Public Radio, a collaboration of all the public radio stations in the Commonwealth. I'm Rick Howlett. Join us next time for another edition of Studio 619 on WFPL.